Hello and welcome to The Third Opinion, which is a podcast exploring public health, media, science, health and well-being, and censorship in the time of COVID. We look beyond the media headlines to create a space for critical thinking, intelligent debate, and the freedom to dialogue and debate. This week we'll be interviewing Dr. Daryl DeMello from India. He is a general physician with 30 years experience and has treated, I think we'll have to check in, I think around 20,000 cases of COVID using telemedicine and an innovative drug therapy program. He's had experience in the medical field with 10 years at Wyeth Labs in India, Boston Scientific in USA and India, and many other places. He has been a vocal voice around the world speaking on early treatment for COVID. I first met him on Clubhouse in 2021, and he has been interviewed several times by Dr. Mobeen Syed, also known as Dr. Bean on YouTube. And today we're going to be discussing outpatient management of COVID and some of the things that he has been doing and ways to approach COVID so to avoid long COVID as well. Dr. DeMello, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hey.
Thank you. Good evening to you.
Good afternoon. How did I get that right? How many cases of COVID have you treated over the last 3 years?
Over the last 3 years, I've crossed 26,000 acute COVID patients.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've done about 1,200 long COVID cases.
Okay.
And I'm now nearing 1,500 post-vaccine or long vaccine cases.
And are these...
Most of the long COVID and the post-vaccine cases are not from India. They're from out of India.
That's what I was wondering. Now, why is that? Is that because you use different vaccines in India or just financially it's a different expectations from healthcare?
The number one reason is we got the AstraZeneca vaccine here.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had problems with that. We've had issues which many of us have learned how to solve. The mRNA vaccines, like the Pfizer or the Moderna, were never ever launched here, never commercialized here, never given here. However, there are lots of people who come back from the U.S. who've taken the or come back from different countries, US, UK, Australia, New Zealand, all over, who've taken the mRNA vaccines who are now showing problems.
So
okay,
you're
now having issues.
So with the main vaccines used in India, which was what, Covaxin and a few other more traditional vaccines, you haven't seen the problems with vaccine injury?
I haven't seen the problem with vaccine injury for one reason. Because at least the people who I gave vaccinations to, and I've given, 7,000 people have been vaccinated by me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before it hit me that this is wrong, but, this is life. Mm-hmm. We believe the system, we believe everything, and we went with that. I put them on a prophylaxis protocol that I expected to prevent any issues from the vaccine, and it played out that way.
So tell us a little bit about
The rest of the country, Covaxin is about 10% or even less than 10% usage. Is mainly the India-made AstraZeneca vaccine that has been used in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Eva?
So with the AstraZeneca vaccine that was made in India, did you have similar problems as we had with people dying from that vaccine?
There are problems. I mean, yes, there are problems. I mean, there are problems, and I keep saying there are problems. Only this morning, somebody called me asking me, why are people suddenly dying, young people suddenly dying? This person who called me used to work for me when I was in business, and he's a CEO of a company of his own. And he's saying, why, my friends? I've lost 6 friends in the last 2 months.
Is that in India?
And I had to explain. That's in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to answer his question to the best of my ability and say, hey, these are something, the classical example what he gave me, and this is a classic example. The person gets up, the individual gets up from his sleep, okay, sits down to have a cup of coffee, read the paper, decides to go for a walk. before he can step out of the house, he goes to the bathroom, restroom, toilet, whatever we call it. And he comes out and falls flat dead. So he asked me, Daryl, what's the cause? What do you think is happening? So I pointed to him to a Twitter post that I put out many months ago about what causes this. I said, see, when we sleep, our baseline heart rates are down to, you know, really baseline. Mm. So if your heart rate is 84 in the day, at night it could be 68 or 70 or 72. Mm-hmm. The cortisol level in our blood, again, goes down when we sleep in the night. Okay? Mm-hmm. When we wake up, we have a sudden surge of cortisol. And I call it it's called the surge of adrenaline, you know, adrenergic enzymes or products that come out, which can then affect the heart and affect the pumping action of the heart. So the electrical conduction in the heart. So it causes something called supraventricular tachycardia. I'll just use the word ventricular tachycardia. The ventricle starts beating excessively. Mm-hmm. It doesn't beat at 80, 84. It beats at 150, 160. So if that continues for a few seconds, 30 seconds or more, you go into ventricular fibrillation. When I say fibrillate, it's like, you know, you have the hummingbird that's jumping, that's fibrillating. You know, if you've seen a hummingbird, you know how what fibrillation means. Mm-hmm. Okay, so fibrillation goes up to 300 beats a minute. Mm-hmm. Because the ventricle is fibrillating now, it's not pushing out blood to the body, to the head, to the legs, to the rest of the body, including the heart muscle. So the coronary arteries are not getting blood pumped out. Because they're not getting blood pumped out from the heart into the coronary arteries, you can go into what's called a cardiac arrest. So, and if that cardiac arrest is not fixed, not revived, the pumping action is not revived, you can have death.
So
you can get what's
So this is similar to what's happening to the sports athletes who, when they're exercising vigorously on the field, they're having the increase of cortisol / adrenaline, and a similar mechanism. Is that correct? Like what you're talking about is the same type of mechanism?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
That is the reason a lot this topic became very, very popular to be, and I got a lot of questions when a guy called Damar Hamlin of American style NFL football player collapsed on the field. I think it was January of this year, or maybe it was January of this year. Okay, so when he collapsed on the field at one of the Buffalo games in Denver, it may have been in Denver, may have been in Cincinnati, I don't remember which place, but I'm guessing it's Cincinnati. That raised a lot of questions. I love American football, so I was watching it. Okay, so and it was late night there, early morning for us here, so I was watching the game. So immediately Twitter lit up, and there were a lot of questions from different people. How, and I kind of tried to explain this whole thing. What happens with high level performance athletes because the surge of cortisol happens. The surge of adrenaline gland substances that come out, you know, you get what's called adrenergic myocarditis, which leads to supraventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation, cardiac arrest.
And okay? if you're lucky enough to be on the sports field, like LeBron James's son, I think just a few days ago, who also had a heart attack during a workout, and you have someone there to reverse what's happening, you can survive much better than if you've just woken up in the morning and you're on your own. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Absolutely correct. Correct.
But Michael.
We've been having sportsmen with raised cortisol and adrenaline levels for decades. And why is this a thing that's happening now, and why are we associating it with the vaccine in any way?
The incidence has been very low in the decades prior. The incidence was almost, you know, what, one a year, two a year? When you're having thousands a year now and people are not waking up from their sleep, because 2 hours or 1 hour before you actually wake up, your cortisol level goes up. Mm-hmm. And if you're in any kind of a stress, you won't wake up in the morning. You'll be dead. And your family recognizes that much later. Yeah.
The what last couple question? Of years have been very stressful in a number of ways for a lot of us. And there's correlation and causation aren't necessarily connected.
Again, I'm a doctor, sir. I treat patients. I'm trying to give you an explanation for why these things happen. I'm not going to get into the political arguments or any of the arguments for or against it. At the end of the day, my objective is to keep people healthy.
Okay, so
the sooner we recognize that this can happen, we can prevent a lot of unnecessary deaths.
So in India, you're talking about this happened in India. Were they people that had just taken one of the Indian COVID vaccines?
That's a question I also asked. Did they take the booster? Because in India, most people have taken one or two. Mm-hmm. There's a certain segment, I'm going to approximate it about 30-35%, mm-hmm. who haven't taken a vaccine. Mm-hmm. Okay, or maybe even more than that, who haven't touched a vaccine. Okay, but assuming what the government says is right, that about 70% of India has had the two vaccines, okay, the uptake of the boosters is down to almost zero. It's less than 1%. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these people who are dying have had a booster.
So that's the question that you asked. And is it a protein-based vaccine that they've taken?
In India we only get these two, right? The Covaxin or the Covishield, which is the AstraZeneca one.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Okay. So that's the only one. I mean, that's the only one really available for boosters here.
Okay.
Now there are people who've gone abroad and taken the Pfizer or taken the Moderna. Those are different people. I mean, I'm not going to bring mm-hmm. those into the okay. discussion here.
Okay. All right, so you're seeing this in India, but what you're mainly treating at the moment, and you said that you had a protocol that could help prevent this. So let's hear about the way that you developed your protocol, because you were treating COVID pretty much from the beginning, weren't you? How did you know what to do?
I've been treating COVID from May of 2020. I got involved with COVID December or early January, around the 9th of January. I was asked to do, this is 2020, to do a series of lectures for certain companies. I'm a company doctor. I'm a corporate doctor. So my practice before that was executive health checkups. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's a middle level manager and upper level manager in some of the companies in India, they have this annual health checkup, which is free for them, for the employee and their family and their wife or wife and children. So which the company pays for. Those reports would be sent to me. I'd be able to get on a call with the call or video call with the individual, with the executive and his family, and go over all their reports. You know, and I've been doing this from 2018. So for me, I was used to talking on the phone or talking on a video call with people. It's much easier to talk and treat and diagnose some things and give them treatment based on what I did. So when COVID hit us, so I was asked to do these lectures. So I put together a very basic presentation, 5-page, 6-page, but I spent a lot of time answering questions. The thing is not about, it's about answering the question to remove the fear, okay, and as to kind of update people as to what we really knew. And in those days, coronavirus was evolving. It was a dynamic situation, evolving every day. Mm. So as we learned more from the Chinese and whatever was released initially, I was able to put together a protocol. Now, my protocol was based on something very simple. It was about treating symptoms. So if you had a cough, cold, fever, I treat the fever, treat the cough and cold, okay, and then see. If you had also had, say, a diarrhea or you had acidity or... In those days, I wasn't even familiar with the word MCAS, mast cell activation syndrome. It came to me much later. So I put together a very basic protocol about reducing the inflammation, killing the virus, and then preventing the clotting. So I'm probably one of the first people in the world who talked about clotting in the lungs, thrombosis in the lungs, whether it's micro or macro, it didn't make a difference, but the thrombosis in the lungs. And I've had a lot of pushback in those days. I used to get slammed by a lot of Indian doctors, foreign doctors, about what I was saying. But, you know, this is life. Eventually, you treat based on symptoms. And for reducing the inflammation, I used a drug called colchicine. C-O-L-C-H-I-C-I-N-E, colchicine. It's a drug used for gout. So everybody said, why are you using a gout drug? Because it gave me a lot of facilities, a lot of benefits to using colchicine, not just for reducing the inflammation, but also reducing things like interleukin 6 and the various interleukins that you have and kind of a work from there. Also reducing the, it's a great drug for vascular disease, heart disease and vascular disease. I've been using colchicine for my post-CABG and my post-angioplasty patients since 2018 on the low dose, the one a day. And
so,
again,
you know how safe it is, and you were also seeing something similar in terms of the symptoms from your cardiac patients before COVID. Is that right? You were seeing symptoms that you knew how to treat. And other doctors, you're saying, were critical of that. How was it that doctors, because, you know, we were hearing early on about the clotting issue, and that seemed to take some time to trickle through to mainstream. How was that?
It came about because of the clotting. I mean, the clotting issue came up from the autopsies of 50 dead patients that the Italian guys did in March of 2020.
That early, okay.
And, that autopsy, when they opened up those bodies and opened up the lungs and found clotting all over, that kind of a hit me. My use of, that's why I kind of focused on the clotting. Now, in those days, we were using aspirin for the first 200 cases. Mm-hmm. I used aspirin. Mm-hmm. And I changed to Plavix or clopidogrel based on week one and week two of the blood counts, of the blood blood tests we did. Mm-hmm. So the hemogram would show me, say, a decreased, very decreased lymphocytes. Mm-hmm. A very increased monocytes, and a depressed level of platelets in the first week. In the second week, it would show me the lymphocytes would go up to 50-60% from 5%, 4%, 9%, 10%. Monocytes, which are 10-12%, would go down to 10 or 8. So you know that you're on the right track. But platelets, from, let's say, the lowest I've seen in a COVID patient, acute COVID patient, was 70,000. And I, at one stage, I thought, is this dengue fever? But dengue fever, commonly you see depressed platelet counts. So I decided, I said, okay, let me treat him and we'll see how this works.
That the colchicine would work to reverse the decrease in the platelets. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but what didn't work was aspirin.
Okay.
What worked for me, because I saw platelet counts beyond 450,000. I saw it as high as 850,000, 650,000, 750,000. So I immediately knew I needed a anti-platelet agent to treat, to suppress the bone marrow, to suppress the platelet production.
You also mentioned,
and kind of bring that down. So that's where I came up with clopidogrel. Yeah.
So you also mentioned that you were using an antiviral drug in your protocol.
Yes.
What were you using?
The antiviral drug I used is a drug called ivermectin. It's been used in 100% of my patients, acute COVID patients.
Now, you're talking to an Australian audience, so you have to be very careful when you use that word.
Not anymore. Yes. You weren't allowed to talk about ivermectin here for 2 years. It was a banned drug because it was coincidentally at the time that they wanted to introduce the vaccine that had to have no other option as a treatment, ivermectin was just banned. Doctors weren't allowed to prescribe.
from
for 2 years, but now we are, so we can talk about it. Let's
so
go.
It was banned from September the 10th, 2021 to June 2023. And the reason for banning, one of the reasons given was it would cause vaccine hesitancy, and was probably because of doctors like you who were claiming to have great success in using it as an antiviral. So tell us a little bit about why you thought it was such an effective drug, because you're obviously not alone and there are colleagues around the world who agree with you and have had great success in early treatment of COVID. Tell us a little bit about how successful it was for you.
See, early on, we identified you got to kill the virus or reduce. I use the word kill the virus. And really, you're doing is reduce the replication of the virus and letting the body take care of the rest. Reduce the inflammation, block the clotting. Okay, so killing the virus, there were lots of drugs. The issue is which is the drug that you will use really well that will help you, and what data do you have to? There was a study published by a group in Melbourne. I think it's Monash University.
Yes.
I forget now the name of the person.
Carly Wagstaff.
That started me off on a pathway saying ivermectin would be the great drug to kill the virus or reduce the level of the virus in the body. And I came up with a thing of using it only for 2 days on a very low dose, 12 milligrams in the morning, 12 milligrams in the evening for 2 days, empty stomach and all that. Again, remember, in those days we were running blind. We were drowning. So we had to find things to keep patients alive. So I'm a kind of guy who'll do what is right, but also be open to changing and saying, okay, this doesn't work, let's try this. And ivermectin worked, colchicine worked, aspirin didn't work. I came in with clopidogrel. At the same time, I gave cetirizine for sore throat, runny nose, to reduce the allergic part of it. And then I gave famotidine, which is Pepcid in Australia. I gave famotidine at 40 milligrams before lunch, before dinner, to reduce the acidity, to prevent any kind of a GI problems. I gave them diclofenac. I wouldn't use ibuprofen because ibuprofen has a entry into the cell, the pathway, which is similar to what the virus uses. So I always gave the example of it's like entering your home and leaving the door open. Anybody can walk in and kill you. Okay, so I came up with diclofenac without realizing that diclofenac also has a mast cell activation suppression effect. I learned about mast cell and the effects much later, maybe October 2020. Yeah.
Do you want to explain the mast cell activation syndrome? Because that's... Sorry? And I just want to mention that we are in J... We are... This is J Air Radio, and this is the Third Opinion, Uncensored. And are we still doing our subscription drive?
Oh, yeah. Yes, $54. You can become a member at j-air.
Please become a member. Exactly.
.au.
Thank you. Sorry, Doctor, interrupting you there.
Yes, we liked it. Yeah, so interested if you could explain to the audience about the mast cell activation syndrome and how that might be related to people that have got either long COVID or ongoing vaccine side effects.
Actually, I'm going to expand it. Mast cell activation happens in so many different ways and so many different diseases. Mm-hmm. Any post-viral syndrome, any viral syndrome, even regular flu has mast cell activation. It is cells that are immune. I mean, your gluten allergy is mast cell activation. Okay, so milk really? Allergies are mast cell activation.
Wow, okay.
So the cells, the immune cells are primed to respond, mm-hmm. to react. They release extra levels of histamine, okay? So that additional histaminosis is what causes all the problems. In COVID, the cells were so primed that they started behaving weird. So reducing the inflammation plus reducing the mast cell activity made a tremendous difference. it's playing the same way in milk allergies, lactose allergies, gluten allergies. So for me now, thanks to COVID and the learning from COVID, I'm now applying the whole mast cell activation issue to all kinds of diseases. Because the same thing with inflammation. I'm applying the learning in inflammation, especially the vascular inflammation, to all kinds of diseases, including heart disease, including vascular disease, including preventing strokes. Okay, so there's a lot of ways of the learning that we've had for the last 3 years will benefit people, will benefit people from and improve their learning on how to prevent, how to live a healthy life. Okay, how to live a healthy life, how to prevent getting heart disease or getting vascular disease or anything like that.
Okay. So tell us what the magical formula is, because what I'm hearing is this is something that applies to a huge percentage of illness that you would encounter as a doctor and as a patient. So what was your treatment for this, and are you using it in all these different contexts as well?
My treatment for the mast cell activation part of it was cetirizine or anything like cetirizine. So you have Allegra, you have loratadine, you have promethazine, you have Benadryl. I give you brand names.
They're all over the counter allergy treatments we get in them in Australia. We have cetirizine.
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
Correct.
So that reduces mast cell histamine, doesn't it? They reduce histamine. Is that the main thing? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So that combined with famotidine, which is Pepcid. Pepcid is also OTC in most countries, over the counter in most countries.
Yep, you can.
I don't know about Australia.
What,
I'm guessing it is also
here?
Available.
What's not called?
It's called Pepcid.
Pepcid.
I
think it's American. I'm not sure whether we have it here over
definitely
the counter.
Definitely have famotidine generic
okay,
or equivalents.
Okay. Okay. I don't think it's called Pepsin here, that's all. Okay, but they're the different types of histamine, the two different types of receptors for histamine, aren't they? So you're basically trying to knock out the histamine response.
Correct. And again, I mean, most doctors use the proton pump inhibitors for GI problems. I've been using famotidine for years. It's not something that I changed over to you. I didn't understand about the, I know it's a blocker, histamine blocker and all that, but it worked really well. Now when I look back, I say, okay, this is why the whole thing clicked, why I was successful. See, understand that I'm not a scientist. You know, I know my science. Mm-hmm. I'm a clinician. I treat patients first. And I don't have time to worry about science. I treat patients and give them what they need to do to fix them today.
And did you get any kickback from your... Sorry to interrupt. Did you get any kickback from your colleagues or, you know, governments telling you that you're not allowed to do it this way, you have to do it that way? Anything like that in India as we had here in Australia?
Let me talk about colleagues. I had a lot of people telling me that what I was doing was wrong. And these are big-name pulmonologists, big-name physicians in the city of Bombay, in the country of India. Telling me right from April, May, June, they kept telling me that I was doing it wrong. I should be admitting all my patients. And my answer was, no, I'm not going to admit patients until they really need admission. I'm going to treat them. I'm not going to keep them with nothing and let them get blue in the face and then can't breathe.
Yeah.
And they've got shortness of breath. And then you send them to us too late. So I had 3 deaths in my first 10 patients. That really shook me up.
Sorry, so you're saying there was... So this is in the first few months that you had 3 deaths in the first... Because you didn't know what to do or you didn't have any treatment protocol.
Not even 3 months. This is the first week.
Oh, my goodness.
Second week of treatment. We're talking on May 15th. So I had to move pretty fast and decide, okay, am I going to treat this way or what am I going to do? Then I started seeing success. Okay?
The
reason I saw success... Yeah.
Those first 3 patients, what did you do? Because there was no guidelines, were there?
Yeah, the first 10, 15 patients, the first week, 2 weeks, I treated the way I talked about. Ivermectin, colchicine, mm-hmm. Famotidine, cetirizine, diclofenac. Mm-hmm. Okay. When you come to me with a 35 SPO2, which means your
35% oxygen. So they're very, very sick. They're dying.
You're going to die.
Yeah.
Okay. I kept that patient alive. We couldn't get a bed for her. I kept her alive, 55-year-old lady. Kept her alive for 3 days. Got her into a hospital. She died in the hospital. Okay.
So they were coming to you...
Within 36 hours.
But they were coming to you already very sick. And why was that? Because people didn't think there was any reason to come earlier?
Initially, people didn't think they should come earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were treating it like flu.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Even now, they still treat it like a viral infection. It's not a viral infection. This is COVID.
How do you go when you bump into those colleagues nowadays?
Within 2 months, when you have success, no? When you have success and your patients don't die, they don't need to be hospitalized, then people start opening up. So then people started asking me, what do you do, how you do, and all that. And one thing I'll tell you, I mean, I say this to on every live interview I do. The government of India, I praise them for not interfering in the few people, we were initially few and we got larger as time went on, who practiced differently. Mm-hmm. They did not stop us. They didn't cancel my license. Didn't come to my home and tell me you shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had a lot of government officials ask me, and I'm pretty sure many of them have taken treatment for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care who you are. You could be the king of England or you could be a sweeper on the street. To me, you're a patient. And it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, I get a lot of feedback from people saying, so-and-so knows you. I'm like, how? I don't know. Maybe it's on my records, but I don't know. I used to treat patients. And I really didn't care about who they were and what they were doing. But again, early on when you have success, you know that you're on the right track. Then you start really pushing it through.
How
I had people, you know... Yeah.
How did Uttar Pradesh become the scene for them receiving early treatment and having a different approach? How was it that the government there was able to do that? And maybe to explain the contrast with other places
in India. Uttar Pradesh story is linked to what I'm going to say now. I had worked with a business guy, a guy who was a business consultant. And I wanted to open up a state which is famous for tourism. And we had given a proposal to the government in that state to open up the state by 15th of December 2020 for tourism, because they depended a lot on tourism. And I'm told that proposal was discussed at the central level, at the federal level. And the Uttar Pradesh people learned about that proposal and they went out and did the whole four-drug regimen, which was zinc, ivermectin, and something else. I'm forgetting. Doxycycline.
Vitamin C and D, I think.
Okay.
Doxycycline. And explain to the audience that what happened was that people were given these in their homes so that they could commence treatment straight away, because one of the most important parts of treatment, early treatment of COVID, was to treat it early, within the first few days. So these people had access in a way that wasn't available in other states in India and in other countries around the world.
Yeah, that was done because they had no other choice. It was either having a lot of people die,
mm-hmm.
or doing something which was radically different from the protocols being pursued by the WHO, by the CDC and all.
Mm-hmm.
And I praise the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh and the health people of Uttar Pradesh for taking that decision, putting their people first. Okay. And by the way, the same protocol has been used across India. It's not that, but it was never used so publicly.
Mm-hmm.
It's been used in every state. Okay, except for one state called Kerala, where they mandated that the only admissions and they had a lot more deaths than anybody else. Okay, so again, it all depends on the local government and their recognition of their inability to take care of their people. Makes sense.
Did they see a great difference? Because the data that came out of Uttar Pradesh showed just how effective that approach was.
The cases, from the day they launched this program, the cases plummeted. Literally plummeted. I remember the, you know, in the Delta wave, this is Delta wave. The Wuhan wave was much longer, much longer, much, you know, lower number of cases per day. In the peak of Wuhan, I did about 50, 52 cases a day, live new cases. In Delta, I was doing 90 cases a day, new cases.
Wow.
I was getting 1,400 phone calls. My worst day or the best day, whichever way you want to put it, was my birthday, 16th of April. I got 1,400 calls. I missed 1,200. I had my wife take some. I was running around with three phones and talking to patients, say, hold on, do this, do this, do that.
Wow.
You know, so we saw, and I think I did an interview with Bean, with Mobin Said, it's sometime in May, first week of May. Where I predicted that India will collapse. The case numbers will collapse down to nothing, pretty much. I went down by 15th of May. I was down to 15 patients a day. Okay, because the country adopted the Uttar Pradesh model, and it on the quiet, everybody started doing that. And that's how the cases came down.
Because all these drugs are available over-the-counter in Indian pharmacies. Basically, people could access.
Every drug I've talked about is freely available at any pharmacy.
Yeah.
At any medical store, it's freely available. Anybody can walk in and buy it.
Well, it was also
and
the case.
Doctors got a lot of courage to use these drugs.
Yeah.
Well, those drugs were available in Australia in every pharmacy. The only people complaining were happy about the ivermectin situation with the horses. Because they had plenty for the paste. That was the standard joke going around amongst most of the GPs in Melbourne. And it just, I'm sitting here dumbfounded that there could be such a difference in a simple, cheap, effective, no-risk protocol that worked so effectively compared to the lockdown and vaccine protocol that was taken here in Melbourne.
Well, 26,000 patients, how many did you lose? I mean, I hear that you lost three in the first
days. I lost, I admitted 75, and I lost 25.
So 25 out of 26,000 people. That's incredible.
Correct. And mind you, I do it on the phone. Huh?
Yeah.
I have gone in when patients were bad in Bombay City. I have gone in and actually injected them with a drug called enoxaparin or Lovenox, which is a low molecular weight heparin drug, where you stop the clotting. I've also done unusual things of giving vitamin D3, 600,000 units injected into the hip, an iron injection, so something containing 50 milligrams of iron, and a B-complex injection. And I've seen patients recover in 24 to 48 hours.
Who
literally go back to normal.
Who, I mean, you know, there's Dr. George Farid and Dr. Sabine Hazan, and you're working with doctors around the world, obviously sharing protocols, Dr. Jackie Stone. Tell me, who were you all working together and telling each other what was working? Like, how did that work? Because obviously there were some people testing different things, and there, you know, there wasn't a central body coordinating at all. How did it all work that you worked out between each other
what to do? It's strange that we all developed our protocols in silos.
Okay.
We all started treating in silos. It's only in the beginning, and I put out my first video. Which was created by a press, you know, a retired press reporter for me, because nobody was willing to come home and actually shoot. So we did it over 30 Zoom calls. My first video, which is a very basic video on talking about ivermectin and colchicine and what happens in a disease and all that, was actually started middle of May through the middle of June. It took us a month, a little less than a month, to find somebody who'd publish it. And one of the online websites said they would do it as a favor to this lady. today's retired person, and thanks to her, it got out. So that first video was published around the third week of July, okay? Mm-hmm. The next interview I did was this lady doctor from Canada who came to me, Jennifer Hibbard, who came to me in January asking me to do a series of interviews with her. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I learned about other people. I mean, Pierre Corey's testimony, George Farid, Farid Jalali. I mean, I learned about all the people who were... It's funny how we all had the same, a similar protocol, similar approach. Mm-hmm. We all had our differences, but yet we had a similar approach of early treatment.
Yeah.
And I always say, I don't care what drugs you use. As long as you are reducing the virus... You're reducing the replication of the virus, so you're killing the virus, reducing the height of the cytokine storm, so you have to reduce the inflammation for that, and reducing the clotting, it doesn't matter. Okay, I use this as an example. I use a layman example, which is like, I honestly don't care about the earthquake in the sea. What I care about is the tsunami, the height of the tsunami that's going to hit the city. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because that's the damage it's going to cause.
So, you
there?
Yes. So, I'm hearing, because I think I saw you on covexit.com, which was also early on. Jean-Pierre was doing interviews as well. And with Jennifer Hibbard, the first time I saw Jennifer Hibbard was on, she was interviewing one of the daughters of the nursing home in Toronto where everyone had been on ivermectin for treating scabies. And the interesting thing about that nursing home when COVID broke out was that nobody died. And there was the first early sign that ivermectin was effective. Were you aware of that? What had happened there? Because Jennifer became very interested.
I wasn't aware of a lot of these things
till
we got into the lull period, a lower case number period of Wuhan, which was more like November, December of 2020.
Okay. With your you mentioned we've only got a few minutes left, so I just want to ask you just a couple questions. Number one, long COVID. Does that happen if you've had early treatment? Because that's the one thing which seems to be something people are saying, but as someone that's treated so many patients, have you seen much long COVID come out of your 26,000 patients?
26,000. I've seen zero long COVID.
Zero.
And mind you, all these patients are patients and personal friends also. I mean, they become... Yeah. When they come to you, they stay with you.
Yeah.
Okay? Because remember, you've got gratitude. Them through the toughest period in their life. Okay? Mm-hmm. I've had zero long COVID from 26,000 patients. Okay?
So someone once said that long COVID is basically untreated COVID, is what the comment one doctor made.
Absolutely. You're absolutely spot on in that statement. Long COVID is untreated COVID.
So would
I've
your
had
protocol
people who
be
were
effective?
Treated in the hospital... Yeah.
Sorry, would your protocol be effective for those who are suffering long COVID now?
Yes. The same drugs are effective, just that dosages and duration of treatment will change.
Because I'm listening to the story, and congratulations on what you've done and the collaboration between the doctors to come up with a real-world solution for a real-world problem is something that I've just so sadly missed that didn't happen here. Any doctors that were presented with, you know, I had doctors who were telling me, oh, the information's from India, it's no good, so we're going to do what the government keeps telling us. I mean, and so when they say, oh, it was a panic situation, we didn't know the information was there and it was just totally ignored by mainstream doctors across the country.
It was censored. It was more than ignored. They weren't allowed to. It was, anyway, there's a whole political... whatever.
We'll let you vent some at a time, Michael. We have to say goodbye to the doctor.
So the last thing I want to say, though, is that Dr. DeMello is a telehealth doctor. And so if people are interested or you know, need to look at long COVID treatment or post-vaccine treatment, could you just tell us, I did have one question, why is natural immunity so controversial? That was my last question before I share the telehealth details.
Okay, let me talk about natural health immunity in two ways. Mm-hmm. One is, if you had a high level of vitamin D, okay, in your body, vitamin D3 in particular, mm-hmm. you did not get a bad attack of COVID. Mm-hmm. Every patient of ours who really got admitted or died probably had a very low vitamin mm-hmm. D level, number one. And that has been proven globally.
Lots of studies on that.
I learned about that because every time I gave a vitamin D injection, the patient turned around.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, here we have, you know, 600,000 units of vitamin D3 available, and giving that was not a problem. So again, I was probably one of the first in the world talking about vitamin D, vitamin mm-hmm. D3 mm-hmm. being critical for this. When you talk about natural immunity, I mean, people who had acute COVID usually did not get COVID again, okay, mm-hmm. in the first phase. So I was exposing myself openly to patients. I would go into their homes, take off my mask. You see, to travel in the city, I had to wear a mask, but I never carried a PPE kit. I never put on a PPE kit when I went into somebody's home to treat them. I would take off my mask, sit in the hall, or go and see the patient in the room, first understand from the family members what the situation is, go into the room, treat them, come out and have a cup of coffee and come home.
What were your vitamin D levels?
My vitamin D levels was pretty high, 90.
Okay.
In that 80 to 100 range, I maintain it. And I use injections. I don't go with the orals. Because one is injections are freely available. Mm-hmm. They're the same cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know it's going directly into your blood. So the level of absorption of an oral, even if you give a 60,000 unit sachet with lime water, the absorption will probably go up to 3%. It's usually less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're talking about the pharmacokinetics is very, very different when you give an injection versus give a oral, okay? The worst thing what the WHO and the governments, worldwide governments did were locking people up in their homes. They deprive people of sunlight, natural sunlight. And that's probably one of the reasons why initially, they had so many people who died because their vitamin D levels were criminally low. Okay.
I see that you did do a podcast, which is available around natural immunity and discussing that with Dr. Mobeen and you. We have to go.
I've got one word to say.
What?
That we've got a censorship bill coming up. That governments want to tell us what is right and what is wrong and will stop the other side of the discussion. And it happened in COVID. And I know we've only got 10 seconds, but you can't let this happen again because the other side of the discussion around COVID did not happen in Australia. It was banned. Although I did see a funny cartoon. They say that the newspapers are only half the size now because they only print half the discussion.
Michael, okay. That's a good one.
I want to just share Dr. Daryl DeMello's telehealth link, which is www.daryldemello.in. So, yeah, if you want to find him, Dr. Daryl DeMello.
He's in India somewhere.
Telemedicine services, and you can do virtual healthcare. And as you can hear, huge amount of success with things that we're still working out here in little old Australia.
Thank you.
We're still waiting for any sort of instruction that vitamin D might be good for you for any sort of immunity. But one day we'll catch up with your medical expertise. Thank you.
Dr. DeMello, thank you so much for taking the time to share your wisdom and your amazing story. And I'm just so grateful for doctors like you, because even though many people didn't listen, there were a lot of people who did listen and made good choices and are healthy as a result of your work. And maybe we can have you back on again, as I'm sure things will continue to unfold.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you. Thanks for your time. Bye.
So that was
quite
a clear signal through to India.
Yeah, that was amazing.
I'm
presuming he's in India.
It's their
state-of-the-art radio station.
That's right, which you could become a member of.
Yes, j-air.com.
Very interesting discussion again, Eva. Thank you very much. Although the medical things I didn't understand a lot, but that's fine.
But I think for anyone who is still unwell because of
vitamin D,
COVID, and
vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc,
colchicine, ivermectin, all sorts of. There's a lot you can do, and
all cheap and available.
Yeah,
have been.
Yeah,
always been.
And pharmacies like.
I'm not mentioning. No, I don't sell any of that.
Oh, okay.
We only do better lips.
All right, folks. Have a good week. It's Tisha B'Av today.
It just started about 20 minutes ago.
So if you're religious, you shouldn't be listening to us.
No. You should. Well, that could be the case, but you can get it on the podcast, and you can start eating very soon.
Okay. Doesn't it start tonight?
No, it's been all day.
Yeah, it started last night.
Today was the fasting day.
Yeah.
No wonder
you're hungry.
It's true. See you later, everybody.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. שיר איתך שוב משתוקק להחליף זיכרון יום בו הלכת בתחושה של הרגע שבו תשוב שפגשתי פתאום